So I'd also just like to welcome you here, very many familiar faces, and for those of you who are new, a very warm welcome. It's a rare and a precious opportunity, I feel, to have a weekend. Day longs are indeed also precious and wonderful, but a weekend is double precious and wonderful. So this weekend I wanted to focus the teaching, the talks and the instructions to some extent around this theme of the engaged mystic. And I think it will become more clear as we go on through the weekend, the reasons why I feel this is such an incredibly important theme and investigation for us. I'd like to start this morning reading you something from Martin Luther King, Jr. He said, "Every now and then I think about my own death and I think about my own funeral. I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. Tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. Say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace, that I was a drum major for righteousness, and all of the other shallow things will not matter. I won't have any money to leave behind. I won't have the fine and luxurious things of life to leave behind, but I just want to leave a committed life behind." This piece from Martin Luther King Jr., which he said just shortly before his death, actually has always continued to touch me over the years and to reflect on what that means to leave a committed life behind. I have a friend who has a slightly unusual sense of humor, but she... I went to her 60th birthday party, which was in a very rural town in Massachusetts, you know, which, anyway, you can imagine. Very ordinary people were invited to this birthday party, people who'd never practiced before or never heard of the teachings before. And the first part of the party was a sort of very normal 60th birthday party, you know, with food and conversation and all. And then everybody was invited to go into this other room where she'd laid out all these trestle tables with a seat and a chair for everyone with a piece of slate in front of each chair. And the invitation was to design your own tombstone. Which, of course, many people found rather an odd thing to be doing at a birthday party or really at any other time in their life. But it rather appealed to me. Obviously, she was someone who'd done a lot of practice and maybe not had appreciated. Not everybody was in the same mind state as her. But I thought it was a very sort of unique way to celebrate a birthday, to design your own tombstone. And I often actually think that would be a wonderful way to begin retreats. You know, to take a few minutes to design your own tombstone. Most of us, I think, who undertake a meditative path in some way would not want to engrave upon our tombstone, you know, "Here lies the perfect breather," or, you know, "Here lies someone who's well-read in Buddhism," or "Here's someone who's a great sitter." I think most of us who come to this path really have very much a kind of twofold intention. I think one of those intentions is to cultivate an inner life which is truly a refuge, a sanctuary. To cultivate an inner life where we have access to a sense of calm and ease and balance and compassion and wisdom, kindness. I think the other aspect or the other intention that most of us bring to this path is the real curiosity and the real wish to understand how to embody everything we learn on a cushion in the rest of our lives. How to have relationships and lives that feel meaningful, committed, kind, clear, how to contribute to our world in a meaningful way. These are, I think, enduring questions, and I would say there are no easy answers. But in a way, this is really the path of understanding what it means to be an engaged mystic. Not someone who's retreated to a cave or a monastery, not someone who's lost in the world and all of the events and experiences it can offer. Now, the most frequently asked question that is brought to myself, that is brought to most Dharma teachers, is how do I maintain this practice outside of retreat? And how do I live this practice off the cushion? The most frequently encountered frustration that I come across is people saying just how difficult it is to be awake and mindful and present in their lives. That it seems so easy in a way to lose, that's the word that's often, the phrase that's often used, I've lost my calmness, I've lost my mindfulness, or I've lost my awareness. Now, I think this is an important question for us to reflect on. It's not about finding prescriptions. I mean, any of you who've done residential retreats know that we end every single residential retreat with a whole long list of prescriptions about how to sustain this. Not about how to maintain this, but about how to sustain this, how to keep this path alive in our lives. And we know it's a whole other, it's a whole investigation unto itself. And it's not about the frustration of feeling, I've lost my concentration or I've lost my mindfulness. But it's really about not looking for a right answer, but the willingness to look at what it is that bridges this gulf that can seem to exist between this calm and collected meditative life and this life out there. What does our practice look like off the cushion? Now, I think it's very important to remember that the Buddha didn't just teach meditation. He didn't just teach meditation. I find myself sort of hammering this point over and over again. The Buddha didn't just teach meditation. He taught a path of awakening. And formal meditation plays a part in that path of awakening, a very important part. But it's so important to acknowledge that formal meditation is always intended to be in an ongoing dialogue with wise speech, with wise action, with wise effort, with wise livelihood, with integrity, with wise view. That is what forms the whole of the path of awakening. I think many Westerners tend to make something of a hierarchy and kind of feel like the real work, the real practice is on the cushion. And everything else is somehow secondary or far less significant than that. You know, 2600 years ago, people came to the Buddha distressed, talking about many of the same sorrows and places of bewilderment that we meet in our own lives. What to do about aging, about sickness, about death. What to do with loss and confusion and despair. And the Buddha's answer was never sit more. Never said that. He never said sit more. He said investigate more. He said investigate and really look moment to moment in your own life what it is that causes suffering and what it is that brings suffering and struggle to an end. And this is not just about time spent on a cushion, but a path of cultivating a climate of investigation and a climate of embodiment and authenticity. And it's a challenging path. It's a challenging path. There's no doubt about it. Now, the Buddha laid out this kind of framework for an awakened life. The first of the cornerstones in that were dana, or generosity, and integrity. In fact, he was the first teacher of his time that made a very direct link between ethics and the calm and the collected mind. He talked about developing mindfulness, calmness, wakefulness, the collected and gathered mind as a foundation in which insight and understanding and compassion and kindness arrives. Now, I think this path was, in the time of the Buddha, no easier than it is for us now. You know, for many people, it's actually, in a lot of ways, easier to be alone and silent than it is to be together and in communication. And yet, this is much of our life, to know how to embrace relatedness, how to embrace relatedness with the world, how to embrace relatedness with other people, how to embrace relatedness with our own hearts, minds, and bodies in a climate of understanding and calmness. I mean, I'm sure many of you have experienced, as most people do experience, that you open your eyes when you're sitting on a cushion and the world appears. And how easy it is to slip into the habits of mind that really undermine that relatedness. How easy it is to slip into the habits of judgment and intolerance and impatience and fear. And this is why we practice. Not to blame ourselves. Not to shame ourselves or place endless demands upon ourselves. But, you know, the great genius of the Buddha, as far as I understand it, is that he really did place this path of awakening in the classroom of our lives. Not elsewhere, but in the classroom of our lives. If you think back, some of you who are familiar with this, if you think back to the time when Siddhartha lived, and the spiritual and the sort of religious ethos of that time was really about transcendence, about transcending the world, about transcending the body, transcending the mind, transcending life. In fact, all of that, everything in life, more or less, was seen as being a problem, as an obstacle to liberation. And so, you can also imagine, 2,600 years ago in India, life was probably pretty hard. So it's no surprising that the first impulse was to get out, to find somewhere better, to find somewhere easier. Life was often treated in a kind of an aversive way. Now, in some ways, we can see that kind of spiritual and religious ethos as belonging to 2,600 years ago. You know, and the way that people tried to get out was by sort of, you know, overcoming their bodies, you know, abusing their bodies, overcoming their minds, disconnecting from life. And you can see it as a sort of historical story. But actually, it's really not a historical story. It's really a contemporary story. You know, I know when I've taught, like, in situations where people have, like, really extreme difficulties. You know, like, a few years ago, I taught a retreat in Cuba, where life is pretty difficult. And at first, I couldn't quite connect with what people were looking for in the practice, because they kept talking about wanting to get some really neat experience. You know, some really neat concentration experiences. And they wanted to get bliss and rapture. And it sort of became clear to me after a few days that it was kind of the ethos, the same ethos, that operated in the Buddhist time 2,600 years ago. When things are really hard, it's very human to want to get out. I know with people who teach like mindfulness in situations like prisons, again, when the invitation is first offered to people, like, you might want to be present, they say, no way. They say, why would I want to be present in this? It's too hard. It's too difficult. And, you know, in lesser afflictive situations, but we all have afflictive situations in our lives, you can see that first impulse of how that first impulse arises, like, how do I avoid this? How do I get out of this? How do I escape from this? You know, we find other ways. You know, we turn on the TV, we open the fridge, you know, we go to a movie. And yet the timeless teaching of the Buddha was, yes, this is human. This is understandable. It's not to be blamed. It's not to be judged. But it is to be understood that it doesn't work. That it doesn't actually work. That avoidance and disconnection actually don't work. And so he was quite, it was so radical in this time in speaking about turning towards that which we would be prone to flee from. Turning towards the body, turning towards the mind, turning towards the heart, turning towards life. And really exploring and questioning, is it possible in the midst of this sort of wild and unpredictable and complex life to nurture a heart that is not governed by struggle and by torment? To nurture a heart of receptivity, of peace, of spaciousness, of compassion. You know, and in my understanding, the very nature of that teaching is the teaching of the engaged mystic. Not about disconnection or divorce, but about being present in our lives. A little bit about the structure of this weekend together. For those of you who've been here before, you'll know that we do hold these days of practice in a climate of silence. So one of that is turning off your phone, which is a tremendous blessing. But it's also about, just for the time that we're in the formal context of the retreat here, just letting go of the verbal communications. Understanding that there will be time, by the way, there will be time for questions during the day, there will be time at the end of the day for, you know, some conversation and time to meet together. But really, I think embracing the preciousness of silence. Where else do we learn really to listen inwardly? Where else do we really learn and have the space to really listen to what our own bodies, our own minds, our own hearts, and in fact, all of life is actually saying to us? So embracing the silence, certainly in all the grounds around here in the dining room. I'm going to talk a lot about this opportunity to gather and to collect our attentiveness. But gathering and collecting our attentiveness is really about a commitment to simplicity. Now, you will find coming here that your life has followed you onto the cushion, for sure. You know, you will find that your life has followed you on to your walking path. How would it be any other way? But this is not the space to engage in those familiar patterns of, you know, how do I suppress this, overcome this, transcend this. This is about how can we be present within that life and find the greatest level of simplicity. You know, a couple of the instructions I was first given in meditation practice, which have really come back to me very strongly recently. The first of the instructions I was given is to find a secluded place with long views. You know, and here we have something of a secluded place, as much as we ever get in the middle of London. You know, we have something of a secluded place. We have the seclusion of the silence. But we also, more importantly, have the seclusion of mindfulness. You know, because all of you who've been on retreat before know you can be in the most simple of environment and be incredibly busy. You know, we don't need to spend our time reading all the leaflets through the day or, you know, the instructions on the tea urn or the tea boxes. You know, really being aware of that tendency, you know, to address agitation with getting busy. I might mention it's another strategy that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Agitation makes us get busy. Busy makes us more agitated. So the secluded place is also the inner commitment we make to mindfulness, to collecting, to gathering our attention, to being as present in the moment as we're in, as we're able to be. The long views, you know, part of it, you know, I think nature is always a tremendous ally in cultivating a sense of long views. Being able to appreciate the sky, the trees, the, you know, the grass, everything around us. But the long views is also about a sense of perspective inwardly. You know, many people in meditation practice have a really rather undermining tendency to be constantly evaluating their practice by the contents of one sitting or one walking. Oh, I'm a terrible yogi, you know. I'm such a mess, you know, my mind is so scattered. I just give up, I can never do this. That's short views. Long views is actually bearing in mind the reality that we can never actually assess our practice or our own being by the contents of one sitting or walking. Long views is about remembering really what this path is dedicated to. Moment to moment, the cultivation of kindness, of calmness, of mindfulness, of simplicity. The other instruction that was given to me, it was about being free from indebtedness. And if I put this in context, I mean, I'm sure any of you have known, if you've ever been financially indebted, you know, the torment it creates in the mind, the anxiety and the worry, and how, you know, the endless thoughts that are generated. And the Buddha wasn't just talking about financial indebtedness, he was talking about emotional and psychological indebtedness. And if we want to know what we're indebted to, just close your eyes for 5 minutes and see what keeps dragging your attention to it. You know, the unfinished conversations, the parts of our lives we feel uncomfortable with, what we haven't been able to let go of or understand. Being free of indebtedness, I think sometimes it's an outer act of peacemaking in our lives, but very often it's an inner act of peacemaking, of generosity, of forgiveness, of the willingness to let things be. And that is really a moment-to-moment practice.